These are the headlines. Local sources say at least 17 people have been killed in U.S. airstrikes on Syria, the first such attack under the Biden administration. Russia reacts to the U.S. airstrikes on Syrian oil, slamming that it was a violation of international law. Thousands of people stage a rally in the Yemeni city of Sa'ada to slam the Saudi blockade on the war-torn country. The U.S. says it has launched airstrikes on a number of facilities in eastern Syria. Washington claims the facilities were being used for rocket attacks against American troops in Iraq.
We're confident in the target that we went after. We know what we hit. And we're confident that that target was being used by the same Shia militia that conducted the strikes.
The Pentagon said the attack was carried out at President Joe Biden's direction and caused material damage, but local Syrian sources said at least 17 people were killed in the U.S. attack. In recent months, a series of attacks have hit American forces and facilities in Iraq. On February the 15th, rockets hit an airbase in Erbil Airport, killing a non-American contractor. A number of U.S. contractors and a service member also sustained injuries. Iraqi resistance groups condemned the attack. They have also denounced recent attacks on the U.S. embassy in Baghdad's Green Zone. In October, the groups reached a conditional ceasefire with American forces present in Iraq. Political commentator Rick Sterling says the U.S. manufacturer situations in order to justify its attacks on Syria. Take a listen.
In the past, there have been, some people call them false flag operations. Basically, events are manufactured to give a pretext for escalating conflict or for making some political moves. So what you're saying about the Iraqi resistance forces denouncing these attacks, points to that possibility taking place. I think the larger context is that over a year ago, the Iraqi parliament decided and basically passed a resolution that the United States troops should leave Iraq. And that's the larger context in which the U.S. forces are supposed to leave there, and clearly Washington does not want to pull them out, and so they're looking for justification to stay there. And we've seen the rise in the last couple of months. We've seen the rise of terrorist activities from ISIS in Syria as well, and that's another area where what you were suggesting earlier. The U.S. has exploited ISIS at times for its own ends.
Russia has denounced the latest U.S. airstrikes on Syrian soil. The Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs said the attack targeted a sovereign country and a member of the U.N. According to Russian media, the ministry said the U.S. attack violated international law, and this is unacceptable. Moscow has urged Washington to determine who was targeted. Syria's permanent representative to the UN has demanded an end to what he called politicizing humanitarian issues in his country. Bassam Sabah said some reports have been presented to the UN Security Council about the humanitarian situation in Syria. He said those reports are full of faults because they have turned a blind eye to crimes committed by terrorist groups. Sabah said the Syrian government has managed to improve the humanitarian situation despite all the challenges it's facing. He said the challenges include what he called unilateral coercive measures by certain countries. The Syrian envoy was addressing a Security Council session via video conference. He also said that the U.S. continues to steal Syrian resources. People have demonstrated in Yemen to voice anger at the ongoing Saudi blockade on their country. A rally took place in the northern city of Sa'ada. Protesters said the Saudi blockade is deepening the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. They called on the international community to act without double standards and hold the perpetrators accountable for the violation of their rights. Saudi Arabia imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen after it waged its ongoing war in March of 2015. The blockade has hampered aid imports to a Yemen already dependent on humanitarian assistance to survive. The UN has called Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The White House says it'll recalibrate relations with Riyadh as the U.S. prepares to release an intelligence report on the gruesome murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
As you know, we've committed to the release of an unclassified report that would come out from DNI and not from the White House. And, of course, our administration is focused on recalibrating the relationship, as we've talked about in here previously. And certainly there are areas where we will express concerns and leave open the option of accountability. There are also areas where we will continue to work with Saudi Arabia, given the threats they face in the region.
Saki told reporters that Washington is considering a range of actions on the table regarding Saudi Arabia in response to the investigation. U.S. President Biden spoke with Saudi Arabia's King Salman by phone on Thursday. According to the White House, Biden stressed the importance of human rights and vowed to make the relationship between the two countries more transparent. The U.S. intelligence report is expected to be released soon. It will reportedly single out the kingdom's powerful crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, for approving Khashoggi's death. The U.S. State Department said the findings will be a step toward ensuring accountability.
This relationship, to be sure, is multifaceted, but we want to ensure that we bring those facets much closer in line with our interests and our values. And this is an important part of that, this being the release of that report and the accountability that will ensue.
Price said the release of the report is an important step in the direction of transparency, stressing that Biden will review the entire U.S.-Saudi Arabia relationship. Saudi insider-turned-dissident Khashoggi was killed and dismembered inside the country's consulate in Istanbul in 2018. The CIA has directly linked bin Salman to the murder. Murdered at, as Saudi Arabia's de facto leader has denied any involvement. Riyadh says Khashoggi's murder was a result of a rogue operation. Saudi Arabia, of course, enjoyed cozy ties with former President of the United States, Donald Trump, who blocked the release of that report. The United States has announced its bid to rejoin the UN Human Rights Council and seek an election for its panel for the 2022 through 24 term. Washington's return to the Geneva-based council is aimed at eliminating the focus on its ally, Israel. Doesn't this really draw the immediate conclusion that Israel is guilty of breaking international law, especially in the occupied territories, that it needs the U.S. shielding?
The Israeli regime is infamous for breaking a long list of international laws, which has drawn worldwide condemnation. Back in 2020, the United Nations General Assembly condemned Israel the most, as it adopted 17 resolutions against Tel Aviv's violation of international laws. That's almost three times more compared with the rest of the world combined, standing at six. The Gaza Strip has been subjected to the longest blockade in modern history. In 2007, Israel imposed a land, sea, and air blockade on Gaza. The inhumane blockade severely restricts imports and exports, people's movements in and out of Gaza, and access to agricultural land and fishing waters, denying Palestinians of their basic human rights. All of these actions are against international law. Israel also demolishes the homes of Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds and elsewhere in the West Bank in order to provide land for building illegal settlements. According to the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2334, settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem Al-Quds are a flagrant violation under international law. Adding to that, Israel frequently targets military positions inside the war-hit Syria, hitting more than 500 spots in the year 2020. Moreover, Israeli aircrafts repeatedly violate Lebanon's airspace on a daily basis, which, again, is a clear violation of international law, in this case, Lebanon's sovereignty. The regime is also the only possessor of nuclear warheads in the region. However, it has always refused to accept or deny having nuclear weapons. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls for nuclear transparency, as it has never allowed inspections of its nuclear facilities and has refrained from joining the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Recently, reports revealed that Tel Aviv was expanding its Dimona nuclear facility, which provides the regime with material needed for its nuclear arsenal. The regime is estimated to have between 100 to 400 atomic warheads. That is why Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program. Meanwhile, it has carried out several assassination operations against Iranian nuclear scientists over the past decade, all in defiance of international law.
Well, we don't really need the U.S. Claims for us to believe that Israel is breaking international law. It's been doing that ever since it claimed independence 70 years ago. And it's the worst offender. There's no question that Israel, it's an occupying, it occupies, terrorizes 70 years. No other country. You can think of Myanmar. It was very bad with its Muslims, but not even one-tenth of what Israel does really every day.
Washington's latest bid for the UN Rights Council comes 3 years after former President Donald Trump left the body, now claims to place human rights at the heart of its decision. Ironically, it has also said that Israel, a human rights violator, is targeted unfairly at the council and needs to be protected. The Tel Aviv regime, or Tel Aviv's crimes, have drawn a strong international condemnation, especially from the UN. However, Washington accused the rights body of displaying hostility toward Israel. How can the U.S. use the human rights card against other countries, yet protect one of the worst human rights violators, namely Israel?
3 years after former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration withdrew from the United Nations Human Rights Council, his successor Joe Biden has moved to rejoin the panel for the 2022-24 term. Washington walked away from the council during Trump's term in office in 2018, accusing it of displaying hostility toward Israel. That is why Washington's bid to rejoin the Geneva-based rights body is aimed at eliminating the so-called unfair focus on Israel. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has been widely condemned internationally for its violation of international laws. The occupying regime is routinely on the UN General Assembly's agenda since late 2006 and is condemned for violations, as mentioned, in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Previously, Biden stated his opposition to the expansion of illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. He also said the only way to reach peace between Palestine and Israel is a two-state solution. However, his administration's move to shield Israel against international outcry over its crimes somehow contradicts his earlier remarks about the Palestine-Israel issue.
Of course, it's undermining the UN. The UN's very weak anyway. It's got really no political clout because it's still ruled by the veto in the Security Council, and any reasonable requests and laws are vetoed. So it doesn't really have any clout now. But it does have these committees, and it does get some kind of press coverage, and it has credibility. People don't see the UN as an evil force.
The Israeli regime's malicious acts are not hidden from the eyes of international human rights bodies. However, Washington's attempt does not only seem unfair, but also undermines the UN Rights Council's credibility. When Israel holds the record for the most broken UN resolutions, the credibility of the UN as a rights body comes into question.
Myanmar police have beefed up security in its largest city of Yangon as tensions grow over a coup the army staged earlier this month. Police block roads in downtown Yangon that is pushing groups of protesters to flee the area. On Thursday night, police also launched a crackdown in another Yangon neighborhood. It fired shots into the air and set off stun grenades. Myanmar's army took power on February the 1st, detaining a number of officials, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The army alleged fraud in November elections in which Suu Kyi's party won against a pro-military one. Protests have continued since then, calling for the release of the political leader. So far, three protesters have been killed and hundreds arrested. A British government watchdog says the police status are disproportionately using their stop-and-search powers against blacks and other ethnic minorities. The governmental organization tasked with inspection of British police forces said blacks, Asians, and other minority groups are four times more likely than whites to be stopped and searched. It noted that unless a reason was provided for such an imbalance, the risk the police is taking is, or actually the police risk losing the trust of the communities, I better say, The UK government has defended the measure taken by the law enforcement, calling them necessary and potentially life-saving. This is while human rights groups say the unnecessary use of such powers exacerbates racial tensions in the country. The global death toll from the COVID-19 pandemic has topped 2.5 million, while nearly 113 million people are infected with the fast-spreading disease. Almost half of the fatalities have occurred in just five countries, the U.S., Brazil, Mexico, India, and Britain. The U.S. has the highest death toll, with more than 508,000 fatalities. The country has also registered over 28.4 million infections. Brazil has the second highest death toll worldwide. The country's total fatalities have now surpassed a quarter million. The South American nation has also registered more than 10 million cases. While in the U.S., many have been shocked at how non-whites continue to be disproportionately denied access to a COVID-19 vaccine. The key culprit appears to be the endemic non-investment in poor areas, putting African and Latino American communities at yet another major disadvantage. On that story, we have Ramin Mazohiri reporting from Chicago.
The racial disparities in who gets a dose of the desperately wanted coronavirus vaccine continues to roil the United States. African Americans compose 12% of the U.S. population, yet they have only received 5% of the vaccines. 60% of America is white, and they have gotten 60% of the vaccines. The mainstream media is repeatedly blaming the problem on African Americans by emphasizing their mistrust of the federal government due to a shocking national history of medical experimentation on black communities. However, the small share of whites and blacks who say they refuse to ever get vaccinated is the same, 14%. Multiple studies point to a simpler explanation. Vaccines are overwhelmingly being sent to white neighborhoods. In the United States, vaccines are being issued at places like pharmacies, clinics, and hospitals. But perpetual underinvestment in lower class and non-white areas means many black communities simply don't have this medical infrastructure. Similarly, African American and poor neighborhoods don't have adequate schools, roads, businesses, work opportunities, and many other basic requirements for healthy living. Since almost the start of the pandemic, it's been clear that non-whites are drastically overrepresented in the so-called essential worker occupations, and that non-whites are four times more likely to be hospitalized by corona and three times more likely to die from it.
And then we also have a lot of our Southside hospitals that are closing and can't meet the demand if they were to get the shipments. They don't have anywhere to store them. So that's another reason. A lot of our clinics are being closed in the inner communities. It's time to get the boots on the ground. It's time to show faith by coming into the black communities, setting up pop-up shops for vaccines.
Latino Americans are getting only 11% of vaccines, despite being 18% of the population. The failure to equally share coronavirus vaccines with all classes is expected to further exacerbate the nation's long-standing socioeconomic inequalities, which the pandemic continues to reveal. Ramin Mazohiri, Chicago.
And that's it with international news.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran Today.
About 3 years ago, Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the JCPOA, or Iran nuclear deal. He subsequently imposed escalating punitive sanctions on Iran. Even the coronavirus pandemic didn't change this. In response, Iran progressively stepped out of its JCPOA constraints on uranium enrichment and other nuclear activities. But Trump's successor is talking of stepping back into the deal, beginning with three gestures. So perhaps Iran will reverse its withdrawal. I say perhaps because talks alone just aren't going to cut it for Iran anymore. Iran has said not enough. The U.S. must verifiably end the whole economic terrorism of Trump-era sanctions, or else it will have failed to exercise due diligence in practicing its international obligations. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has urged that the U.S. and the EU Troika violated all of their JCPOA commitments, and therefore don't get to set conditions for Iran. Stay tuned for the latest developments in Iran's nuclear program and Western reactions. U.S. President Joe Biden has installed a new team of diplomats with the task of undoing and repairing the damage done during the Trump era. U.S. violation of the JCPOA is but one of those damages. But the Biden team has been demanding Iran's full compliance to the JCPOA as a precondition to renegotiating that deal, lifting U.S. sanctions on Iranian individuals, removing U.S. objection to an IMF loan to Iran, and facilitating humanitarian trade with this country. There is one thing pressing the Biden administration to make an urgent move. That is a recent law passed by Iranian parliament. The Strategic Act of the Islamic Consultative Assembly to remove sanctions. The act obligates Iran's government to block snap inspections by the UN nuclear watchdog from February 22nd if its partners to the JCPOA did not implement their own commitments under the deal. The aim is to restore balance in parties' commitment to the deal by getting sanctions lifted off Iran. This would ultimately save the deal, which was originally meant to limit Iran's peaceful nuclear program in return for sanctions relief. A letter was sent to the UN nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, by Iran's permanent representative to that Vienna-based organization, Kazem Gharibabadi. In it, he clarified the reasons for the December law. Our guest highlights the important points. Mr. Beheshtipour always has a studied, honest viewpoint to put in. Once a news manager at Press TV, he joined us on Skype.
When Iran saw that it can't trust the American side, it moved towards the implementation of the law enacted by the Iranian parliament. The responsibility for reaching this point rests with the United States, because it can easily return to the JCPOA. If it returns, Iran will also go back to the JCPOA.
Mr. Shariat Madari is the editor-in-chief of Kehan Daily, a renowned face on the Iranian political spectrum. Let's hear him out.
The point about the additional protocol is a snap visits from any place at any time. That is, they took away all our intelligence. We should not have accepted it at all from the beginning. The inspections have been so rigorous that after the JCPOA was reached, Obama himself said the inspections that were put in place for Iran are a system that is unprecedented in the history of the IAEA. We need to stop our voluntary implementation of the additional protocol. First, it is legal to withdraw, because it was voluntary. And second, it had to be approved by the parliament, which it wasn't. And third, they took all our intelligence. So this is a very important thing that is unfortunately being done with a delay.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has, among many voices, urged President Biden to return to the JCPOA and lift all of Trump's sanctions. He said, surrendering to law is not a fault. Do not shy away. What is bad is surrendering to force. Also, in a telephone conversation with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, he said of the nuclear deal, it is a document approved by the Security Council and the product of the long efforts of Iran and the six largest countries in the world. The JCPOA has a specific framework and is unchangeable. It is impossible to enter new topics into the JCPOA. This Rouhani stressed in light of the fact that even Europeans have been trying to rewrite the deal to get Iran to namely scrap its basic defenses, its ballistic missile program. Mr. Sadatian is a political expert who served as ambassador to the UK. His insight is that of one who's seen the other side up front.
Now they're making demands beyond what we agreed on. That we do not necessarily discuss at this point. They demand to discuss Iran's missile range and Iran's regional influence. There's a lot to talk about. You have to first prove your goodwill and then come back for talks. But the fact is that Iran has a natural influence in the region. How can they ask us to reduce our influence? We need to stick to the facts on the ground. The Islamic Republic has reached such a point of reliance and strength that it's not afraid of negotiations.
Mr. Ajarlu is editor-in-chief of Mosallah's magazine. Let's hear a word from the editor.
We negotiated and implemented the JCPOA once, and there is no reason to return to it again with preconditions. In our view, the JCPOA is a multilateral agreement in which we fulfilled our obligations but did not benefit as much. What the parliament has done is a clear signal that we're ready to go back to the pre-JCPOA era and even reconsider inspections, and that we can leave aside dealing with the IAEA with goodwill.
So far, the U.S. and Iran have been stuck in a negotiating stalemate. According to some diplomats, disputes about who must make the first step are absolutely counterproductive. And instead, the process needs to be carefully synchronized.
It seems that this step-by-step mechanism, meaning that they take steps and Iran acts accordingly, and takes measures in five gradual steps. In addition to, implementing the parliament's passed law is sufficient and sometimes can be given. It might not be necessary to refuse to allow in the inspectors under these circumstances.
The United States is not in a position to set conditions. It has violated and broken its promise. First, all sanctions must be lifted, not on paper, but in action. Therefore, we must verify it. So, some gentlemen are wrong when they say that we will return immediately after the Western side returns. It is not so. Sanctions must be lifted and we must verify them. For example, we have to be able to do our business, import or export. When we exported our products, the money has to return to the country. Well, this takes time. We have to make sure that the sanctions on the banks are lifted.
To look at Biden's three-step plan to resolve the dispute over the nuclear deal, the U.S. said it would accept the EU High Representative's invitation for discussions with Iran and the five other signatories of the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. At the same time, Biden rescinded Trump's claim to have reimposed all UN sanctions on Iran via a JCPOA snapback mechanism. Other signatories and the UN Security Council at large had denied the Trump move had any validity anyway, as the U.S. was no longer party to the deal. The U.S. has also dropped special restrictions on Iranian diplomats in New York imposed by the Trump administration, which limited them to the Iranian mission, the ambassador's residence, the airport, and a six-block radius around the UN. They will now be subject to the limits that were in force before the Trump era, a 25-mile radius around Midtown Manhattan.
Now it's our turn. They have played their cards and have no trump card to play. That's why they resort to such excuses. The UN Security Council rejected the snapback of sanctions, with an overwhelming majority of 13 member states voting against it. They want to sell this to us as a privilege. They say they have brought in a woman of Iranian descent to the State Department. This indicates that their hands are now empty.
Both countries have signaled their readiness to revive the agreement since Joe Biden's inauguration, but have differed on who should make the first move.
I think we should wait for their practical action, not that we should take the practical action. Our practical action was a parliament's law, which I think we should continue to implement. We have to speak the language of the world, and we're doing just that. If we talk to them gently, their demands will become more outrageous.
Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif has previously signaled a conditional openness to talks with Washington and the other parties over reviving the deal. And he appreciated Biden for acknowledging that Trump's UN sanctions claim had no legal validity, but he demanded, U.S. unconditionally and effectively lift all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled by Trump. We will then immediately reverse all remedial measures. Our remedial measures, expansion of Iran's nuclear activity in recent years, are a response to U.S. E3 violations. Remove the cause if you fear the effect. We'll follow action with action. More to our narrative, but first, let's give other media outlets a chance to have their say.
Welcome. In today's news section, we will take a look at some of the most interesting topics related to Iran's new approach to the JCPOA and the dispute between Iran and the U.S. Mir News Agency takes a look at China's proposal for the future of the JCPOA. The headline reads, "All parties should push for unconditional U.S. return to JCPOA." In reaction to the recent remarks by U.S. officials about returning to the JCPOA, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson said that all parties should push for the unconditional return of the U.S. to the JCPOA as soon as possible. Currently, the Iranian nuclear issue is at a critical stage, with both opportunities and challenges. China holds that the return of the United States to the JCPOA is the only correct approach to resolve the impasse on this issue, said Hua Chunying. All parties should act with greater urgency, work together to implement the consensus reached at the foreign ministers' meeting last December, and push for the unconditional return of the United States to the JCPOA as soon as possible and the lifting of all sanctions on Iran, she added. Urdupoint News takes a look at Iran's foreign ministry's reaction to the U.S.'s latest gestures for easing of tensions. Here's the headline. Iran studies EU proposal to hold meeting of JCPOA members with U.S., according to Iran's foreign ministry. Tehran is considering the proposal of the European Union to hold an informal meeting between the members of the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, together with the United States, Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said on February the 21st. We are studying the proposal, communicate with friends, Russia and China, on the issue. Following consultations, we will make a decision, Araghchi said during an appearance on TV. The deputy foreign minister added that there was a chance to revive the nuclear deal after U.S. President Joe Biden's arrival to the White House. The Russian Sputnik News informs its readers of Iran's stance regarding U.S.'s recent movements. Its headline reads as follows. U.S. return to JCPOA pointless. If sanctions are not lifted in action, Iran's envoy to UN says. While the United States has recently signaled it could return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, no actual steps have been taken by Washington. The United States' possible return to the Iran deal would be meaningless if Washington doesn't lift all sanctions it imposed against Iran first. Iranian ambassador to the United Nations Majid Takht-e-Ravanchi said in an interview with Khamenei.ir. According to Takht-e-Ravanchi, Washington introduced three types of sanctions against the nation. And quote, if even one of them is not lifted, the U.S. return, quote, to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, which former President Donald Trump left in 2018, would be pointless. Well, that's it for the news section. Stay tuned for our show's main narrative.
How did European signatories to the deal support Iran after Trump's violation of the accord? It is true, Europe has been trying to save the nuclear deal. It did vow to protect Iran's economy against the U.S. sanctions, but none of its initiatives have so far produced a satisfactory result. After the U.S. departure from the nuclear agreement, Europe undertook 11 commitments to safeguard Iran's JCPOA interests in areas such as oil sales, insurance, aviation, shipping, and industrial cooperation, but none have been fulfilled so far. the European signatories to the deal have failed to install a working mechanism that could bypass the U.S. banking stranglehold for repatriating Iran's oil revenues. Who could blame them for trembling at the thought of infringing U.S. sanctions? Trump was a bully.
Now, one can say that the U.S. withdrew from the nuclear agreement. A madman like Trump left the deal, a move which the Americans did not approve of themselves. This doesn't necessarily mean that the Democrats, Mr. Biden, and his team are committed to maintaining international standards and saving their face. Mr. Trump acted like a bully on many other issues. For example, he deactivated Obamacare. He built a wall along the southern border to prevent Mexican migrants from coming to the U.S. He even abolished the NAFTA Pact. He withdrew from so many international agreements. His madness didn't only affect the JCPOA.
Iran fulfilled all of its JCPOA commitments until the U.S. pullout. The IAEA verified this 15 times at least. Let's hear an expert say whether Western parties to the deal fulfilled any of theirs.
The Americans did not commit to what they signed. When we asked the Europeans why they didn't intervene, they said we are a group of private companies that are influenced by the United States. The government here is small and powerless. If the government does not have the power, why did they sign and guarantee the agreement? In my opinion, Europe is completely influenced by the US and can only play a decorative role in the negotiations, or in some cases, promote the US position.
If Iran's experience of the first chapter of the JCPOA is any indication of what might happen in the future, is it logical for Iran to participate in another round of negotiations? On the other hand, could the situation get any worse than it is right now for Iranians after the inhumane sanctions that the Trump administration imposed on them?
We created our own problems. For example, what does unbridled inflation has to do with sanctions? Or what about market liquidity that has escalated multifold? The fact that some people take liquidity to the housing market one day and to the dollar and gold coins market the other doesn't have anything to do with sanctions. We have to think for ourselves. How can they sanction a country with 15 neighbors? So the problem is that many of these problems can be solved if we believe in ourselves. But of course, sanctions also create problems.
Iran will resume honoring the nuclear deal in full only after the U.S. has removed all sanctions on Tehran in a practical and verifiable manner. Because, as Ayatollah Khamenei has said, the domineering order has always looked for excuses against the Islamic Revolution. One day it's human rights, once vilifying theocracy, once the nuclear issue, and once regional issues. They're all excuses. The key concern is that Iran won't give in to their domination. Mere words don't help. This time, only action. A new agreement is possible as far as Iran is concerned, provided it also respects Iran's right to nuclear technology for peaceful purposes.
Negotiation is a diplomatic tool and can never be left out. Negotiations are a tool that can be useful or harmful. If done appropriately, it is excellent and helps break deadlocks like the JCPOA, which was the first international undertaking after World War II to resolve a crisis through dialogue. In this way, negotiations are not good or bad in nature. It depends on what, how, and for what purpose we negotiate, and also who are the negotiating parties.
We can't change the subject. The problem isn't what to do to take the U.S. back to the JCPOA. The problem is the lifting of the sanctions. It does not matter to us whether the United States returns or not. Let the Europeans figure that out. The United States has violated Security Council Resolution 2231. Why doesn't Europeans protest? The Security Council must act against it now and issue a resolution. Not only they didn't issue a resolution, they didn't even make a statement or an implicit warning. This is the environment we need to negotiate in.
Reflecting on government obligations with regard to the additional protocol of the NPT, Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, Tehran's decision to suspend voluntary implementation of that protocol would not mean that Iran intends to expel the UN nuclear watchdog's inspectors. The additional protocol allows intrusive inspection of Iranian nuclear facilities, and that intrusion, which allowed in spies and sabotage, is deemed unacceptable. Anyhow, Iranian parliament adopted its December urgency law with its 22nd of February deadline for other parties' recommitment.
In fact, we failed to act during this time. According to paragraphs 26 and 36 of the JCPOA, which deal with the issues related to non-compliance, we had to retaliate immediately after they failed to meet their obligations. We had to stop fulfilling our obligations right away, but we did not do that. We waited so long that Trump left the JCPOA. Their excuse was that Iran's missile industry and Iran's presence in the region should be included in the JCPOA. Besides, they wanted to extend the restrictions indefinitely.
UN nuclear watchdog had Rafael Grossi arrived late Saturday, February 20th, in Iran for talks on the eve of Tehran's deadline for U.S. sanctions to be lifted. This was his second trip to Iran in the past year. Grossi said on Sunday, February 21st, that it had struck a deal with Iran to cushion the blow of steps Tehran plans to take this week that include ending snap inspections, with both sides agreeing to keep necessary monitoring for up to 3 months while Iran stops cooperation with the agency until sanctions are lifted. Meaning that Iran will record the activities of its nuclear sites via the installed CCTV cameras and will store them for up to 3 months. If any desirable development occurs, Iran will hand over the footages to the IAEA, or else will erase them for good. In opposition to this agreement between the administration and the IAEA, the Iranian parliament passed a vote on referring the administration's deviation from the parliament's bill to the judiciary on February 22nd. On the evening of Monday, February 22nd, the same day of the parliament's move, in a meeting with the members of the Assembly of Experts, the leader of the Islamic Revolution stressed his concerns over escalation of such differences, which could be interpreted as divide in the country.
باید حل کنن نبایستی این اختلافات اینجوری رو یا رها کنن به حال خود یا تشدید کنن و نشان دهنده دو صدایی باشن نه اینا قابل حل باید حل بکنن بالاخره دولت خودش رو موظف میتونه به اینکه قانون رو عمل کنه قانون هم قانون خوبی است باید هم به دقت عمل بشه دو طرف در این زمینه همکاری کنن با هم که این عمل بشه
The December law obligates the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, AEOI, to install advanced centrifuges, increase the level of nuclear enrichment to 20%, and halt the additional protocol if the illegal sanctions against Iran are not lifted. Iran insists all these steps are reversible if the parties to the 2015 nuclear deal, the JCPOA, honor their commitments. Iran will remain party to the NPT safeguards agreement, although the government is obliged to prevent foreign access and monitoring beyond the additional protocol. In the U.S., the think tanks Atlantic Council and Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft have published analysis, which warned Biden to race against the clock to escape the so far dangerous game between Iran and the U.S. Robert E. Hunter, the 1990s U.S. ambassador to NATO, believes that Biden must be willing to take some political heat to break the current standoff between the two capitals. He points to the time as a constraint and recommends the simplest first step would be for Biden, by a stroke of his pen, to reverse President Donald Trump's May 2018 withdrawal from the JCPOA. That would challenge Iran to de-escalate. The expert realizes that U.S. domestic politics, Arab states of the Persian Gulf, and Israel are the main factors complicating Biden's decision-making towards the Iran nuclear deal. I asked for a practical solution to the impasse to relations between Iran and the West.
As long as we rely on independence, in its true sense, and on pure Islam, that is fighting oppression, and the West emphasizes its arrogant nature, both sides remain opposed to each other. Its conflict will end when one of the parties gives up its identity. Either we become their servants, or the United States, as Imam Khomeini put it, stops acting so foolishly, stubbornly. As long as this is the case, there will be conflicts. We are by nature opposed to each other.
Mikhail Ulyanov, ambassador to the UN for Russia, one of Iran's two friends among JCPOA signatories, also welcomed the U.S.'s move to join talks. Now is the time for realpolitik and diplomacy, he said in a message to the U.S. The sooner you and your Iranian colleagues, as well as other JCPOA participants, start pragmatic discussions on the way out of the current unfortunate situation, the better. Yet another episode comes to an end, but the show goes on, as do nuclear deal discussions. So do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after. Thanks.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام لسلمة بن كهيل والحكم بن عتيبة: شرقا وغربا، لن تجد علما صحيحا إلا شيئا يخرج من عندنا أهل البيت.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam said to Salama bin Kuhail and al-Hakam bin Utaybah, "Go to the east and go to the west, but you will never find true knowledge except for what comes from us, the household of the Prophet."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In the historical texts of the Muslims, we find that there are very beautiful and interesting dialogues, golden conversations, if you will, between the infallible imams who were appointed by Allah and their respective companions. Now, these dialogues between the imams and their companions had with them these admonitions and these advices which truly can take a person to the levels of perfection. One such imam is, of course, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, Muhammad bin Ali al-Baqir. Peace be upon him and his household. Now, we find that in one of these conversations, Imam al-Baqir says to his companion, "Allah gives the world to those whom He loves and those whom He detests. However, He gives religion, deen, iman, faith to those whom He loves only." So, dear friends, we do find that sometimes the believers, they have a lot of wealth. And when we talk about the world, usually in the traditions, world, dunya, means materialistic wealth. And so here Imam al-Baqir in this conversation, in this dialogue, says that Allah gives the world to those whom He loves. And so we find that the believers have wealth. Some of the believers have wealth and they are well off. But Imam al-Baqir also says that Allah gives this world, this materialistic wealth, to whom He detests, to whom He does not like. And so we shouldn't think that because so and so unbeliever has so much wealth
that means Allah loves them. No, sometimes Allah gives wealth to one he does not like. But apart from wealth, what does Allah give which shows that Allah loves a human being? That, dear friends, Imam al-Baqir says, is religion, is deen, is faith. It is Islam. So when Allah loves you, He gives you the religion. A beautiful piece of advice, a beautiful statement brought to us in this conversation between the companion and Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
When I come to learn from the fifth holy imam, when I come to learn from the sixth holy imam, I understand adab. I understand etiquettes. I understand mannerism. What is the point of me saying I am a Shia of Muhammad al-Baqir and Ja'far al-Sadiq? I come for Kushali and Wiladat. I celebrate, but I go there and I give a bad image of Muhammad al-Baqir and Ja'far al-Sadiq. What is the point? I have to place my responsibility of my akhlaq and mannerism of the Ahlul Bayt in action. I come and celebrate, great. I come and take part, this is fantastic to be able to take part in the wilada and celebrate and listen. This is the beginning. But when I am out there, I must reflect the mannerisms. If I am just there because of my ego and I want to show that I know some knowledge, I have read some books and now I want to debate. This is not debating, has an art. It is something that is not just anybody can do. It needs a medium. It needs some measurable circumstances. It needs some people to be there who are what? Who are unbiased. Or people there who are not necessarily of either side. To give each side an opportunity, share equal time, whatever. Now, this is unfortunate and it is something we have to speak about. Some people might say, okay, why are you speaking from the minbar about it? It is of the utmost importance because if we do not highlight it, I have personally been receiving emails and messages and WhatsApp and things, and some of our youth are very angry. Oh, we have to go back, we have to do this. And they want to create this sectarian conflict. They want to create this hatred. They want to begin this particular battle. No, this is wrong.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.